You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa. Today we are in Madrid.
Hello and welcome to the final cycling podcast of the 2018 Vuelta a España. We're in Madrid, as we heard there, or some of us are. I'm actually in Girona doing some top secret interviews for the cycling podcast. But Fran Reyes and television's Daniel Freib are in Madrid, where, as I speak, the 21st and final stage of the Vuelta has just finished. In part one tonight, we're going to hear from Daniel and Fran in Madrid. In part two, I'll be joining Lionel Burney, remember him, to discuss the race as a whole and the way it was won. We'll also hear in that part from Teo Gegenhart, who has just finished his first Grand Tour. And in part three, we're going to hear from some of the other riders and sports directors picking out their highlights from this Vuelta. But first, the final tale of the tapa. Well, before stage 21 of the Vuelta, we had the conclusion to the Madrid Challenge, the two-day Women's World Tour race, won overall by Ellen van Dijk. But the second stage in Madrid was won by Giorgia Bronzini. On the brink of retirement, she's about to step into the sports director's car at the new Trek Factory Racing women's team. And a great way for her to bow out after a very long and very successful career. We'll have a lot more from the Madrid Challenge in the cycling podcast Femina, which will be coming out towards the end of next week. Another rider who is retiring from professional cycling, Igor Anton, was given a special reception before the start of stage 21 today. He is retiring with immediate effect, the Dimension Data rider from the Basque Country. As we expected, it was a pretty pedestrian final stage into Madrid before they hit the finishing circuit. There were a couple of breakaways featuring people like Alessandro De Marchi, Thiago Machado, Yetsi Ball, Joey Roscoff, people we've seen quite a lot of in this Vuelta trying, and in some cases, in the case of De Marchi, for example, succeeding in their breakaway efforts. On the finishing circuit, Madrid, quite technical, one dead turn with 4 kilometres to go, which caught a lot of people out. Bora Hansgrohe, very evident, very visible on the front, trying to set things up for Peter Sagan, who's not won a stage in this Vuelta. And this today may have been the final time we see him in the rainbow bands of world champion, of course. It was a chaotic sprint with the quite farcical spectacle of the quick step train, which has been so effective. Turning around, looking for their leader, Elia Viviani. Michael Morcov, Fabio Sabatini at one point were kind of shouting at each other, asking where he was. Well, he'd lost them, but it didn't seem to matter because Viviani prevailed in the end, came through a lot of bodies, and Sagan finished very strongly as well, but not quite strongly enough to beat Viviani, who took another stage win with Sagan second, Giacomo Nozzolo third, and Danny van Poppel fourth. It meant that overall, Simon Yates is the winner. Enric Mas, second at 1:46. Miguel Angel Lopez, third at 2:04. Then Stephen Kruijswijk, Alejandro Valverde, Thibaut Pino, Rigoberto Urán, Nairo Quintana, Jon Izagirre, and Wilco Kelderman knocking Tony Gallopin out of the top 10, which was a shame for Tony Gallopin in his first effort at riding for general classification in a Grand Tour. So Yates in the red jersey, of course, is overall winner. Alejandro Valverde in the points jersey. Thomas De Gendt finished in the best climbers jersey. Simon Yates also took the combined competition. Bauke Mollema, well, a lot of competition for this, and Thomas De Gendt was surely in the reckoning too, but Bauke Mollema was declared the super combative winner, the most aggressive rider. And the one we've all been waiting for, best team, Movistar. Now it's over to Daniel and Fran in Madrid.
Daniel, the calm after the storm. Where are we, man?
Well, Fran, we're very close to the finish line. Which area of Madrid is this?
This is Centro, Cibeles, and we are pretty close to Chueca and Malasaña, two of the most trendy neighborhoods in the capital of Spain.
And, Fran, we're partaking in a Madrileño traditional custom. We're drinking Mao beer.
Yeah, not the best beer I've ever had, is it?
A little bit nondescript, not very characterful, but you know, it's better than San Miguel. We started this Vuelta in Malaga with a San Miguel, and we're going to end it with a Mao. So I think we've actually, you know, we're on an upward curve.
Yeah. You know, I spoke to Julian Dean earlier to find out what he was drinking. Let's hear.
I'm having my favourite Alhambra Reserva beer. So from Alhambra, so it's my favourite beer of all the world, actually, so happy to find some of that in the bus after the stage.
That's great, because I have been telling the listeners of the cycling podcast for the whole Vuelta that Alhambra, the green one, is one of the best beers all over Spain. So it's great to see that you share my point of view.
Absolutely. To me, I've been all over the world drinking different beers when I've been riding and racing and working and cycling, and this is definitely one of the best beers you can buy.
So how are you going to celebrate this victory?
So we're waiting for Simon now, obviously. He's on the podium and doing all the press and stuff, and we're actually keeping it pretty quiet. We're on a hotel outside the city tonight, and we're all travelling out there, all the girlfriends and the wives. And I think the most important thing for us is our team owner, Jerry Ryan's here, and it's a really important day for him, a really big moment for him. You know, he's invested a lot of the 7 years of this team, and it's really a big reward for him.
Yeah, enjoy that, because this green beer and all the things you've gone through in these 3 weeks are the biggest reward you are going to make.
Yeah, no, very much so. And you know, it's you keep trying to achieve these great things all the time, and you keep trying. And at some point, if you keep trying, you end up in the right place at the right time. And that was this for us. And also, really think, you know, there's a lot of things we can still work on, a lot of things we can improve, which is also a good thing, because that means we can get better.
We will think of those things tomorrow.
I've already got them in my head.
So that was Julian Dean, DS for Mitchelton Scott. Quite an amazing Vuelta for this team.
Yeah, it was, Fran. And I think Julian Dean and Matt White and the staff at Mitchelton Scott deserve a lot of credit for the strategy that, you know, we've heard so much about in this Vuelta, this idea that they were going to ride very conservatively. And also, you know, setting this sort of artificial goal of having a better second half of the Vuelta than the first half, and that was really, at least that's what they were saying, was their only goal. And you know, it was quite comical to think back to the first summit finish, the summit finish where you indeed took your girlfriend on a first date, was it?
No, third date.
And it was called Alfaguara.
Yeah,
Alfaguara. And it's quite comical to think back to that day and Simon Yates gaining time almost by accident, and after the finish appearing very sheepish and almost kicking himself, because you know, he knew that he shouldn't have attacked, he knew that he shouldn't have gained time, that wasn't in the plan at all, and it was almost as though he was expecting a telling off from the direct sportifs. And it was a theme through the first 10 days of the Giro, and even on the 2 days in Andorra, when we were speaking to him in the morning, he kept saying, "I'm going to ride cautiously. I'm going to ride really, really cautiously." And sometimes he struggled to be cautious because he clearly had fantastic legs. But what a great strategy it turned out to be.
Yeah, I mean, he was cautious. He was defensive, yet very aggressive. You know, it was a pretty great to see that there is another way of defending the leader jersey of a Grand Tour than shelter behind the team and do the minimum accelerations possible, thinking of recovery. He just has this spirit of going all in at all times, and that's, for me, it's pretty refreshing.
Yeah, I also think though that we're starting to see just how talented he is. We're seeing it in the mountains. We're noticing how when he attacks, the attacks hurt more than the attacks of a lot of other rivals. You know, we've seen this trend in Grand Tours over the last few years whereby attacks tend to burn out pretty quickly. Guys go away, they get 100 metres, 200 metres. And Simon Yates' attacks tend to stick, don't they? I mean, even the other day when he bridged across to Miguel Angel Lopez and Nairo Quintana, wasn't it, at the time? Who were always, no, Mas.
Was it? Yesterday it was Mas.
Sorry, it was Mas, yeah. But when he decided that he was going to make that effort, It was inexorable, his progress towards those two guys. You know, when you think back now to, as a lot of people have thought back to, those first flickers of Simon Yates' talent on a grand stage when he won that stage in the Tour of Britain. If you go back and watch that stage and you watch his final kick on an uphill finish, it all sort of kind of starts to make sense. You know, you think of his first stage win in the Vuelta 2 years ago in Galicia, and the sort of kick he showed, the finishers' sort of ability to win on that. Well, it was a steady uphill finish, but again, you know, these are rare qualities for certainly then a young rider, and very much in contrast to the other three Grand Tour champions that we've now got, British Grand Tour champions, Bradley Wiggins, Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas. He is someone who has shown a great deal of talent very early.
Yeah, and I'd say he's different to pretty much any other Grand Tour winner of the last years in the sense that he's pretty punchy, solid and everything, but I would say that other riders, I'm thinking about Fabio Aru, Chris Froome, and so Nairo Quintana and so on, they tend to be more consistent than flashy. You know, this victory that Simon Yates got in this Vuelta, in terms of the amount of aggression it has involved, we can only compare that from the recent years to Vincenzo Nibali's victory in the Tour de France 2014. Another two guys that caught our eyes and they pretty much formed one of the main talking points of this last day of the Vuelta are Miguel Ángel López and Enric Mas. Probably with them two, who are 23 years old, and Simon, who is 26. It's pretty much one of the youngest Grand Tour podiums we've seen in the history of cycling.
Yeah, pretty remarkable. And it looks as though this is going to kind of be the shape of things to come, the generations coming, stage racing. It's interesting, you know, often you can go for years and think that you're on the brink of a transitional period, a bit of a power vacuum as far as the Grand Tours are concerned. There's no obvious outstanding candidate to build a dynasty. You know, when you come out one dynasty, which we're probably coming out of the Froome dynasty now, you always looked at who's going to be the next guy to build that dynasty. And up until very recently, you sort of looked around and you thought, well, I don't really know where the next great stage racer is going to come from, because there weren't that many obvious candidates. And then in the past couple of years, we've seen several emerge, and Dumoulin is certainly a candidate, and López, I would say, is obviously has his weakness in time trialing, but the way Grand Tours are moving, if they continue to move in that direction with fewer and fewer kilometres of time trialing, then there's no reason why he can't win multiple Grand Tours. Simon Yates, the same thing applies, and Enric Mas as well. And yeah, Enric Mas pulled out a fantastic time trial in Vuelta. So, you know, a lot of the time, those guys are at the mercy of the Grand Tour organisers and trends in cycling. You know, what is a Grand Tour going to look like in 3 or 4 years? But at the moment, it looks as though, certainly in Dumoulin, but I would say both Yates brothers, Miguel Ángel López and Enric Mas, you've already got the nucleus of the kind of cast of characters that are going to dominate stage racing in the next few years.
Yeah, we can add maybe Egan Bernal, Michał Kwiatkowski and some of the Team Sky guys. And
Kwiatkowski?
Yeah. Kwiatkowski, stage races?
I think so.
Fran, I think this has been a fairly definitive, this has been a fairly emphatic statement to the effect, this was a statement to the effect that Kwiatkowski is not going to be a factor in 3 week stage races over the next 3 or 4 years.
Oh, Mr. Freebie, I can't but disagree with you.
But how do you back that up?
I mean, I think he is a pretty good climber. He has this punchy kick that can make him get a lot of bonus seconds, and he has still the consistency as to make pretty good, solid long climbs, and then he has a good time trialist.
Where is the evidence of this? Where is the evidence of his ability on long climbs? I mean, fantastic rider, and I've been proven wrong about Michał Kwiatkowski before. I've infamously called him a vanity signing for Team Sky, and he's been pretty good signing. However, I fail to see how this Vuelta has done anything other than reinforce our preconception that Michał Kwiatkowski is not a guy for the Grand Tours. I mean, he's really struggled badly in the last week, but struggled as far as obviously, you know, riding with the best riders in the mountains. He's been trying to get in breaks, and so his focus has changed. But he had gone out of the general classification very early on in this Vuelta. In Fran, this was a Vuelta, and I think that in time, you know, when people look at this Vuelta, they'll realise how anomalous, what an unusual Vuelta this was, in the sense that there were so few long climbs. And the Vuelta, there's a characteristic of the Vuelta, but I think there were two climbs in the whole Vuelta that were over double figures in kilometres. which is so, so different from the other Grand Tours. And I'm going to be very curious to see the route of the Vuelta. When is it going to be announced? In January, usually, isn't it?
Yes.
And whether that's tweaked slightly, because I think that this one went maybe a little bit too far in that direction of short climbs, punchy climbs, and not much in the way of the real test climbs that we see, that decide really the outcome of the Giro and the Tour. Isn't it so fascinating how it makes a huge difference as soon as you go over 10 kilometres and as soon as you go over 16, 17, 1800 metres in altitude, then different abilities come to the fore and different riders come to the fore and riders fall away. And the collapse or the struggles of Alejandro Valverde were entirely predictable in this Vuelta, and yet we had all been kind of duped and hoodwinked by the fact that in this Vuelta, you know, there had been a lot of climbs, there had been a lot of very, very steep climbs, but they were short climbs and the efforts were 15 or 20 minutes. And as soon as we got to climbs where the effort was 30, 40, 50 minutes, Valverde started to look very ordinary again.
Yeah, also bear in mind that Alejandro Valverde always struggles with altitude, because usually he does his training camps in an hotel in the road of Sierra Nevada, Hotel El Guerra, which is more or less 1600 meters of elevation, instead of doing them in doing these training camps in the altitude of the high performance center, which is 22,100, if I am not mistaken. That makes a difference, that made a difference on the Giro 2016. He lost the Giro basically because he couldn't cope with this altitude. And in this Vuelta, I think it has been a factor, even though the main reason for his demise in the last two stages was basically that he had too much racing on his legs, just like Michał Kwiatkowski, because let's remember that he was in the Tour de France, he was in the Tour de Pologne.
Fran, look, it's possible in 3 or 4 years, it's possible that he would, you know, he could develop his abilities. And the fact that he wants to do it, I think, you know, I heard him say in a press conference in this Vuelta that he wants to give Grand Tours a go at some point in his career. I think he said that. And if the motivation's there, then we've seen with Sky before, you know, that it was Geraint Thomas, they've transformed riders to a certain extent. But I think it will be a long, long process. And he certainly, Michał Kwiatkowski in his current form, in his current configuration, is not a Grand Tour rider. Anyway, Fran, I want to talk about Spain. I want to talk about the Vuelta as a whole. I think this Vuelta has been fantastic. In one respect, this Vuelta has been fantastic, has been in showing off Spain and showing off the variety, particularly in the northern regions. We didn't spend a lot of time in any of them, but I found the transition from Galicia to Asturias to Cantabria to the Basque Country absolutely mesmerizing. You know, every one of those regions is very subtly different. Extremadura, we didn't have a stage there, but we had a day where we drove all the way through. That's the sort of region in the southwest, bordering Portugal, very remote. And there aren't really any big cities there, are there? I think we stayed in a hotel one day and they told us that I think the population density in Extremadura was something one person per square kilometre, or maybe even less.
No, not that little, but yeah, it's it's very, very low.
Yeah, so they were some of my highlights in terms of, you know, the Vuelta as a showcase of Spain.
The Vuelta, from a touristic point of view, is almost say that it couldn't be better, because they really take the race to very different places every year. Even if we do remember the stage because of the unfortunate incident in the finish line, that stage finish in Estaca de Bares, the northernmost lighthouse in Spain, was gorgeous. And like that, we can have a long variety of examples in the Vuelta every year. For me, the highlight of this Vuelta, and this is of course a pretty chauvinistic point, has been watching young Spanish cyclists thrive. For a while, we have been talking a lot about the retirement of Conto, the retirement of Furito, the probably soon-to-be-retired Valverde, and wondering who was going to take the baton. And in this Vuelta, we saw first Oscar Rodriguez triumph in La Camperona, and above all, we saw the blossoming of Enric Mas, who, hey, by the way, you know, he got a painting today from Patrick Lefebvre.
Oh, really?
Yeah, apparently Lefebvre was so happy with his performance in this Vuelta that he asked a painter, friend of his, Deutsch, to paint a nice, beautiful one with Enric Mas and some of the Wolfpack people. I spent a couple of minutes speaking to Lefebvre. Do you want to hear that?
Let's go, Fran.
So here we are with Patrick Lefebvre, manager of Quickstep Floors. Just tell me how happy you are after this Vuelta.
Very happy and also very emotional, because we beat a record 67 victories, but most of all, second place of Enric Mas. We took him, I think, 4 years ago with my young team. And of course, we knew he was very good, but we came in the Vuelta, at least the team came in the Vuelta, to hope he should do between 10 and 5 in the GC, yeah, and maybe win a mountain stage. And now he win a mountain stage and do second in the GC, so I cannot be more happy than this.
Did you hear that yesterday on the press conference, Enric said that he would love to stay on this team for his whole career?
I hope so. This is a big compliment for us, because I'm sure we have a good team, we are very professional, and we treat very well the young riders. We don't press, we don't put pressure, because we win a lot, so we take our time. But he's going a little bit faster than we thought. It's okay. Now, of course, the most difficult thing comes, because then you have to confirm and next year what you did this year. But I think with a little bit of good intelligence, in October we have a meeting with the team. I saw somewhere that he dreams to do the Tour de France, but maybe we should try 1 year Giro Vuelta, and then Tour. Then he's only 25, so the road is open for him. And first of all, now it is very late to engage riders, but of course in the future, if we make this progression, we have to find also one of two riders who can help him in the mountains. Mm-hmm.
So the team is going to evolve along with him?
I hope so. He has a 1 more year contract, and if I find the necessary money, why should I leave my young people? Mr. Bakala invested 5 years ago 3.6 million in all those young people. Vaco, Chalafilippe, Cavagna, Mas, Schachmann, whatever. I think they all became, it's fantastic, I think they all became professional.
And one last question about the future, it's unavoidable to ask. Has the Patrick Lefebvre found the funding left necessary for next season?
Not yet. We have a budget, but I hoped it to find something more. We can survive, but of course 2020 is the day after tomorrow.
So Daniel, that was Patrick Lefebvre, and the beer is almost over.
Well, Fran, we can't come out of an interview with Patrick Lefebvre and not talk about wine. Yeah. Patrick Lefebvre, big wine lover. I want to talk about my viticultural highlights of the Vuelta. Because we've talked a lot about beer on this Vuelta. We've talked about the differences between our Estrella Galicia and our Estrella Damm. And I couldn't remember the name of the one in Murcia.
Estrella Levante.
Exactly. We haven't talked enough about wine. Revelations for me, particularly over the last couple of days. We've been in Catalunya, well, we came out of Andorra, we stayed in Catalunya. We had, there was a red from Coster del Segre, which was very interesting, not a very well-known appellation. And do you know what? I also learned the Catalan for Tempranillo. Tempranillo being probably the most common grape in Spain. It's the main grape in Rioja and Ribera del Duero. Last night I learned the Catalan for Tempranillo. Fran, am I pronouncing this right? I don't really know how to pronounce. Uy de Yebre.
Huile de Lièvre.
Yeah. It's difficult to pronounce Catalan, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it's quite different to Spanish, especially because it has all this mixing between the vocals and the, yeah, it's difficult, but at the same time, I have to say, it sounds great.
It does, and very easy to understand if you understand Italian. So, my parting shot of this Vuelta, Fran, will be a recommendation. If you get a chance, it's quite difficult to find, I think, but the Costeres del Segre, a Catalan red wine, then give it a go. It's a bit different, very different from Rioja or Ribera del Duero that you'll find pretty much anywhere in the world.
Well, with that piece of advice, Daniel, it's been a real pleasure to share these weeks with you.
Thanks, Fran. Hasta la próxima vez.
From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa. Very grateful to them for their support. And a reminder that Rafa hosts regular rides every day of the week from more than 20 of their clubhouses around the world. One that's coming up, and I know you'll all be looking for bike rides now that the Vuelta is over, is Cross Prestige if you happen to live around Manchester. This is 100 kilometres of rolling terrain, tracks from muddy bridleways to flowing single track. There will be checkpoint locations and a supplied route. That's in Manchester, as I said, on the 4th of November. The level required to do this is intermediate/advanced. See rafa.cc for details of your local ride, including that one. So I've been joined by Lionel Burney. Hello, Lionel.
Hello, Richard.
You're there home in not Watford, and I'm still in Andorra. I think I know where I'd rather be.
Well, I think I know where I'd rather be.
Lionel, you've been watching the last week or so of the Vuelta from the luxury of your not Watford home. What have you thought? I mean, you were here for the opening part. How has it been for you as a viewer?
It's been really good. I mean, every stage has there's been some sense of suspense, hasn't there? I mean, the Vuelta, Daniel's made this point, and I think it's truer now than ever, that the character of the race is so markedly different to both the Giro and the Tour, in the sense that even the sprint stages, the flat stages, the ones that Elia Viviani has won, you know, an awful lot of climbing involved. And so it's a kind of stage race, isn't it, in sort of every sense of that. It's a race where, you know, the breakaways get up the road and they have a better than even chance of staying away, and I think that makes it more interesting. I think the fact that the GC was very close until the last few days was also, it gave us that sense that, well, anything could happen in Andorra. And I think Simon Yates's collapse at the Giro, I felt that it was very unlikely that lightning would strike twice, but there was still that possibility, and I'm sure that possibility was lurking in the back of his mind. And what was really fascinating was watching how he adapted the way he raced here compared to in Italy in May, but also the way that Movistar and Astana in particular tried to unseat him. You know, Movistar get quite a bit of flack, don't they, particularly because they kind of collapsed a bit over the final two mountain stages, but not for the want of trying. And you know, tactically they were trying to upset the apple cart, as were Astana. And you know, it's not easy.
Absolutely, the opposite of what they did is to ride very conservatively and try and defend your position, and they didn't do that.
No, they didn't. And I think, you know, you can't criticise people for failing. You can criticise people for sort of sitting tight and holding what they've got, and they didn't do that. And I mean, there are so many sort of highlights. I thought, you know, Thibaut Pinot's two stage wins were really well executed. You know, he was kind of out of the GC picture really, but got two impressive wins. I thought the one at Lagos de Covadonga was just a thrilling stage, really. Enric Mas, you know, now is inevitably going to have the expectation of being the new Alberto Contador, and I thought it was quite telling that in his interview with Eurosport, you know, he batted that one straight back and said, "No, I'm Enric Mas," which is the kind of the default cliche response of an athlete who actually in the back of their mind thinks that perhaps they could be the next Alberto Contador. And then of course there, you know, Michael Woods' stage win, with the sort of human story behind that, with him and his wife, you know, having a stillborn son, you know, that you couldn't be unmoved by that. And the way he rode in those last 500 metres, I mean, you'd have to have a heart of stone, as impartial as we're supposed to be. You'd have to have a heart of stone not to have been up out of your seat, kind of urging him to get over the line, just because of how much he was putting into it. And even the stage of the final week that looked on paper like it would be a bit of a snooze, the finish that Yellow Wallace pulled off, you know, that was another great stage.
Wallace, Wallace, Yellow Wallace, Yellow Wallace.
Deliberate error there, Richard, just giving the pronunciation police something to do. I feel they've been almost redundant. You know, there's a lot of layoffs by the Home Secretary of pronunciation police in recent months, and
it's the first area for
just trying to do my bit, you know. But all in all, I think, and again, it's really it gives a completely different perspective, and listening to the podcast it kind of fills in, gave me a sort of 3D vision of the race that I enjoyed. You know, I mean, not sort of bigging you guys up too much at all, but I thought it wasn't as slow a burn as Giro sometimes has been in the last few years. The first sort of 8-9 days had enough interest about them, particularly with Simon Yates getting the red jersey at the end of the first week, and the kind of the fact that was kind of unexpected for him, really. I think even he at La Covatia, even he looked like it might be a bit early. They're sort of slightly reluctant to get the red jersey at that point, and I think when he got it back again, having let it go out on loan, so to speak, to Jesus Herrada, when he got it back, he said, "Well, I feel like I've kind of earned it this time." And then he really, well, he rode, barely put a foot wrong, did he, in a week when, like I say, that nagging doubt must have been there. And I think it's the mental strength to get through those final few stages that was as impressive as anything.
It's interesting you talk about the route and the effect that has on the racing. Somebody asked us on Twitter what we thought of a piece that appears on the RAFA website at rafa.cc, written by Herbie Sykes, our colleague, an Italy-based cycling journalist. I would respectfully disagree with the premise of Herbie's piece, actually, which is that the Vuelta is a sort of grand tour for the Snapchat generation. It's a grand tour designed for people with short attention spans. Given that you know, some of it, and Daniel's touched on this, that maybe some of the finishes were too gimmicky and too extreme, but you're kind of dictated to also by the terrain, the geography of a country, and in Spain there are lots of these short, steep climbs, so why not use them? I think another point that Daniel's made is that the Vuelta, of the three Grand Tours, is the one that has really, over the last decade or so, developed its own very distinct personality. And I think it makes it subtly different to the other two. And it does make every day kind of exciting. And partly that's the route, and partly it's the field, and the fact that you don't have big sprinters teams controlling things. And that stage, the one by Yelly Wallace, was, you know, as you say, potentially a snooze fest, but there was a great finish. And again, you couldn't kind of be failed to be moved by that, because I spoke to Yelly Wallace a lot at the Vuelta last year. He was in so much pain and so much trouble, having had several crashes, broken bones. He struggled on, he somehow finished. And I think, you know, speaking, we'll hear in the final part of tonight's episode from Thomas de Gendt, who's the King of the Mountains at the Vuelta, but he actually picks out that stage win by his teammate as his highlight of the Vuelta. He knows how much work he does for the team that goes unseen and unrecognised. But, you know, again, just returning briefly to Herbie's argument, and I think he's being a little bit provocative, but there's nothing wrong with a race throwing up excitement every day. I don't think we should be putting kind of, you know, the slow burn type races or stages on some kind of pedestal. I don't think there's a kind of moral argument for quite, you know, long, boring stages and races that take a while to come to life. Why not? Why not have some excitement, some intrigue, some drama every day? You know, thanks partly to the route, but also to the riders.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I like a contrarian argument every now and again, but I think the fact that it is different and it feels different to the Giro and the Tour is refreshing, particularly at the end of the season. You know, you want people to be switched on and paying attention and enjoying the race, rather than kind of thinking, well, come on, let's wind up the season and let's all you know, we've had enough of this. And I think paradoxically, the Vuelta benefits from the fact that the stakes are that little bit lower. You know, the Tour de France is so tense and tight, and no one wants to concede an inch. And if somebody gets into sixth place, they're not going to try to do something to move up to third and risk slipping down to 10th or 15th. Whereas in the Vuelta, there is a bit more of that sense of freedom. You know, Valverde will obviously be disappointed not to be on the podium, but, you know, he was trying to win the race, not just sort of settle for second or third. And I think we saw that from a lot of riders, Miguel Angel Lopez, Stephen Kraswijk, you know, that, you know, their fortunes went in differing directions in different phases of the race. And I think that is because it isn't the be-all and absolute end-all of the season. Your career and your salary is not going to necessarily be made or broken by slipping a few places or gaining a few places. And I think that encouraged aggressive racing as much as the terrain. And what was really interesting was that the goat track finishes were spectacular. The stage wins there for Oscar Rodriguez at La Camperona and for Michael Woods on those, you know, crazy finishes were two of the highlights of the race. But the damage done overall was not devastating. No one really was put totally out of the picture by those two stages. And in fact, it was on the more kind of motorway finish on the first day in Andorra where Simon Yates turned the screw. It was and that was an absolute humdinger as well. We really saw, because perhaps they thought this is an opportunity to make some, you know, to make some gains. We saw some really open racing, and an awful lot to enjoy. I think
two really good stages, yeah, to form the climax to the race. Who'd have thought, though, at the start that those three riders would be on the podium, and that Richie Porte, Vincenzo Nibali, who are the two riders who were perhaps most people's favourite at the start, would finish, but we would really barely see them. We saw Richie Porte once or twice. Vincenzo Nibali had a go on occasions, but they were far from their best. Credit to them both for finishing. Both are going on to the World Championships, and that was perhaps the reason for it. Peter Sagan as well, again, not at anywhere near his best, but he finished the race. But very surprising to go 3 weeks and for those three riders to be bit part players, really, in the drama. And on the podium, we have Superman Lopez, Enric Mas, and Simon Yates. I mean, Mas, the big surprise. And it's interesting to wonder how that will play with Quickstep, who have developed a team to target other races and not go for GC. You know, I thought this was their whole... the whole strategy at Quickstep was to... you know, concentrate the resources away from the kind of all-consuming drive to challenge for GC in a Grand Tour. And so the question now for Mas and for Quickstep is, will they build a team around him to support his quest now to try and win one of these races? Will he move on to a different team? Who knows? But it's an amazing season for Quickstep and a problem that, you know, most teams would love to have. But an interesting dilemma there.
Yeah, it is. I suspect that, you know, Mas will kind of have it won't be a sort of a seamless path to kind of domination. I mean, again, we've got to just remember that the level and is just that little bit lower. The pressure is just that little bit lower. He's very young still, only 23. This was only his second Grand Tour. I mean, he made his Grand Tour debut at the Vuelta this time last year. He's clearly a very, very... big talent, but I don't think there's any hurry to kind of thrust him forwards. They could afford to just let him be the GC rider while they concentrate on hoovering up stage wins and see where it takes him, and then it will reach a sort of tipping point where perhaps he needs more resources and has a real genuine you know, go into a Grand Tour as a leader who could potentially win it, and then things might change. But you're right about the age of the podium. Simon Yates, 26, Mas, 23, and Lopez still only 24, and seems to have been around for ages already. Second, third place finish in a Grand Tour this season. That's, you know, a good level of consistency. He'll certainly be wanting to move on from there. But again, you mentioned Port and Nibali, and I'd add Nairo Quintana to that as a past winner of the Vuelta, and, you know, an established podium contender, someone that we assumed would go better in the Vuelta than he had done in the Tour, because history has told us that he tends to go better in his second Grand Tour of a season. I think this is a twin warning that there's a folly of just assuming that past success equals present success, if you like, that the past means that we're going to be in for the same again. There were circumstances that obviously led to Port and Nibali being very much below their best here, and also the folly of predictions. You're right, who would have said Simon Yates, Enric Mas and Miguel Angel Lopez would be on the podium? Lopez probably would have been a lot of people's bets for top three at least here, but Simon Yates, I just thought, yeah, the kind of the mental scars of what happened at the Giro, to put himself into the position, just tweak the way he raced, and execute it so calmly. I mean, Andy Hood, our colleague from Velo News, has used the phrase ice cool or ice cold, and there is something of that about Simon Yates, the sort of devastating clinical way he rode. You were thinking maybe he's struggling here, and then suddenly he's up the road closing down gaps, and that's an absolute nightmare for riders who are trying to gain time, when they look over their shoulder and see him coming up behind them and looking good, and he did that a number of times, particularly over the last couple of days in Andorra.
There's a calmness to him which is very, very impressive, and you know that the predicting is a mug's game, as you know only too well, Lionel. But you think of other riders, and we can't just assume that Enric Mas is going to go on from here to, you know, finish on multiple podiums or win Grand Tours. Andy Schleck is down as a Tour de France winner in 2010, though he didn't win that in the conventional way. He got it when Alberto Contador tested positive and inherited the title. But, you know, he finished second in his first Grand Tour in 2007 at the Giro d'Italia. And at that age, a bit like Nairo Quintana when he finished second at the Tour de France in 2013, at a similar age, you thought he's going to go on and win multiple Tours de France. You thought Andy Schleck's going to go on and win the Tour de France and other Grand Tours. And it hasn't happened for Quintana at the Tour, and it didn't happen for Andy Schleck other than in those quite unusual circumstances. So, you know, and this would have also been in the back of Simon Yates' mind and his team's mind, because there can be a massive leap between going close and winning. And this is why I think this result, this performance, has been so important for Simon Yates. He's backed up what he showed at the Giro by finishing the job. And it was very interesting that in his press conference last night, he talked immediately about, obviously he was asked what next, and he was very clear that the Giro is unfinished business as far as he's concerned. And I don't get the impression at all that he will switch off or rest on his laurels. I think the lesson of, you know, from studying his and his brother's careers is that they are very, very, very focused, committed, dedicated. I mean, I listened back to Kilometre Zero that we did at the Giro about Simon Yates speaking to his first coach, Francis Newstead. He's also somebody who's worked very closely with a number of coaches, and it was interesting when I asked him last night who, if there was anyone at Mitchelton Scott who he would single out as being particularly important, influential in his career. He did talk about his coach, Alex Camier, I think is the pronunciation. And again, he's worked closely with a number of coaches through his career. And I think he's somebody who is incredibly focused on the job, and that's not going to stop now that he's won the Vuelta.
No, and I think there's an element of security in having lost the Giro and knowing that the world didn't stop turning. You know, yeah, it was obviously a hugely disappointing result. It was interesting at La Covertia when he said that they didn't really know what had caused the collapse, or he didn't really know what he could learn from it, because he didn't really know what had caused it. But it was nevertheless interesting to see the the subtle difference to the way he raced. It wasn't as gung-ho, all or nothing, a kind of grabbing at time whenever the opportunity presented itself. It was a much calmer approach, appreciating the fact that you've got to be as good on the last couple of mountain stages as on the first couple. And so I think the security that they've got at Mitchelton Scott, the fact that team has invested in them over a number of years now and will continue to do so with some big contracts that will over time, I suspect, impact and may already be impacting on the types of riders that they have in the team around them, because you know the money isn't infinite, but they have backed both Yates brothers as their kind of long-term bet. And at 26, you know, he's coming into his peak. He's not at the top of it and looking to go over the top. You know, Grand Tour type riders tend to be at their best from sort of 27, 28, 29. There may well be more to come. But it's interesting, you know, a few years ago, Rich, when we've done live events, I remember one in Manchester where we were asked whether we thought which of the Yates brothers would win a Grand Tour first and whether we thought they could even win one. And I made a sort of off-the-cuff joke about their best chance being if they could alternate stages, because they obviously look so similar. Sneak Adam in, on alternate days and hope to get away with it. Do a bit of twin doping. Obviously a joke. But I thought when Adam Yates finished fourth in the Tour, he looked the more likely to be first. But I think Simon Yates has, you know, his results in the prestigious stage races, the Dauphiné, Paris-Nice, Catalunya, you know, they've been so consistent. And you know, he was sixth in the Vuelta 2 years ago, and obviously had the Giro he had this year. And so although at the start of this Vuelta I would have been surprised if you told me, well, Simon Yates is going to win this race, really only because of what had happened to him at the Giro. When you look at the way his career has gone, perhaps it's no surprise, really.
He's a complete rider, isn't he? I mean, Ned Bolting took the mickey out of me the other day because I went on the radio and described him as both a pure climber and a great all-rounder, but he kind of is both. I mean, climbing is he's as good as anybody in the mountains. He's got that kick that pure climbers have, but he is also a great all-round cyclist. And I remember hearing earlier this year about some of his exploits in Belgium. We know that he's a former points race world champion as well, and there aren't many guys who are so good in the mountains on climbs who are former points race world champions. Another young rider who's been at this Vuelta a España riding for Team Sky is a rider we've followed for a number of years, Theo Gegenhardt. It was his first Grand Tour, and he's had a great season and came into this race with very high expectations and fell a little bit short of his own expectations. Here's what he said at the start of the penultimate stage of Vuelta in Andorra.
It's a very difficult stage to go today, but how do you feel on the verge of finishing your first Grand Tour?
It's not been quite what I expected, been a little bit different. I think some big lessons learnt, but still been a really nice race. Always good to race with the guys, and with this team you learn a lot. Different scenarios, we had leader's jersey, which is easy to forget, feels like a long time ago. And we had a lot of stages where we've been close to the podium, also going for breakaways, so yeah, also riding GC the first 10 days, so yeah, I guess in that sense, it's been like a really varied race, I think. On a personal level, yeah, not really what I hoped for performance-wise, but
yeah, what did you hope for?
Just more. I think I was kind of expecting to be on the level that I've been certainly since the late spring, but for whatever reason, the legs weren't anywhere near there. And yeah, it's pretty difficult to recover once you kind of start really getting a bit of let's not say a beating, but once you start being pretty fatigued. So yeah, I was wanting to be on my best form, and I don't feel like I've been there, but just have to look back on the training and racing I did, I think as far back as kind of the end of June, and just take note of everything good and bad, and look forward to next year and also make the most of the rest of this year. Still got some big races to come. So.
Any particular standout memory or lesson that you take?
Yeah, I think just being too ambitious, really, ironically. Training too hard in some moments, pushing the diet maybe too much and not really benefiting from that. Like the body almost pushing back. It's hard when you're young because you're always trying to improve and you're always looking for more. And I think in Burgos I knew that I wasn't quite at my best, but I maybe should have been a bit more patient and let it come to me rather than chasing it, which was ultimately, I guess, what I did in hindsight. So yeah, I still haven't really looked over everything because obviously been racing hard here and trying to stay focused on the moment and each day here. But yeah, I've been thinking about it in the back of my mind, and every year goes past pretty quick, but at the same time I feel like developing at a kind of a normal rate, let's say, and a good rate. So just keep moving forward and staying ambitious, but maybe, I guess, being patient at the same time.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Kiss goodbye to stomach problems with the world's first truly isotonic gel. Science in Sport Go Energy Isotonic. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Question today for Dr. Rob Chard at Science of Sport is from Jeremy Hopkins. Greetings, Cycling Podcast. My name is Jeremy Hopkins. I'm 27 years old from Louisville, Kentucky in the United States. I'm a dedicated listener to the Cycling Podcast Femina and the Cycling Podcast. I've got a nutrition question for the experts. I'm a vegetarian, and although I don't race and I only ride recreationally, I enjoy cycling and want to fuel the best way I can to keep riding. With a diet devoid of meat, what foods can I eat to make sure I'm getting the nutrition I need both pre and post ride? Also, are there any pros in the women's or men's peloton who are vegetarian? Is it tough being a vegetarian while cycling professionally?
Thanks for that question, Jeremy. It's definitely a very topical one. There's a lot of interest in vegetarian and vegan diets at the moment. What I can say is that Science and Sport have got a great range of products to support all athletes, be vegan, vegetarian, or omnivore. And as a vegetarian, you can obviously consume dairy proteins such as whey, milk, and eggs, and these can easily meet your needs for high quality protein. But there are a few additional challenges which you need to address. The first is that although iron is found in vegetables, it's not absorbed as effectively as it is from meat and fish, and this can contribute to iron deficiency in vegetarians. When we look at B vitamins, especially vitamin B12, it's rarely found in vegetable products. So vegetarians have an increased risk of B12 deficiency as well. And finally, vegetarians also miss out on two key performance-enhancing nutrients. They are creatine and carnosine, and these are only present in meat and fish. Science in Sport comprehensively cover the additional vitamin and mineral needs of vegans and vegetarian athletes with their new supplements range. And it's certainly possible to compete at the highest level as a vegetarian. If we look back, we can see that Robert Miller was king of the mountains in the Tour de France and narrowly missed out on winning a Grand Tour, but was a vegetarian athlete, a vegetarian pioneer.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. Very grateful, as always, to them. They have helped us cover our third and final Grand Tour of the season. We couldn't do it without the support of our sponsors and indeed friends of the podcast. If you want 25% off all your Science Support products, go to scienceandsport.com, enter the code SISCP25. I've almost forgotten it there because Fran's been saying it the last few nights, but SISCP25. Now, on the penultimate day of the Vuelta in Andorra, we went around a few of the riders and team directors asking them for their standout memory or best moment from this year's race. Here's what some of them said. Thomas de Gendt, Lotto Soudal, breakaway king and king of the mountains in this Vuelta.
The stage victory of Yellow Alliance is for me, because it's a really nice victory, and Yellow Alliance is a good guy, and we wanted to win a stage, and he did it in one of the most beautiful ways that you could do, so that's for me the most important thing for this Vuelta.
Mitch Docker. Probably the highlight's got to be a few days ago when Woodsy won the stage. We're coming up the mountain. I was in the groupetto and we're just listening on the radio to the director talking through the final kilometre of the stage, and it was amazing. Also, the crowd was just going crazy, even for me, you know, 20 minutes behind. That whole finish to that stage was just capped off with Woodsy's win, and I was just like, this is awesome.
Most enjoyable 20%+ climb you've ever done?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Davide Formolo.
Yeah, we see now we have two stages in Bottas stage in the front. We see we have Emu still fighting for a good result in the GC. We see if possible we'll try with a breakaway today, and then we see how the bunch will ride.
So far, have you been happy with your Vuelta?
I think I cannot be happy. I was just spending a little bit more, but okay. I was here happy for the team, so far I was doing a good job for the team. I was missing a break maybe one day for having such a good result also for me as well. Okay, we have two important stages in the front. I think these two stages can change all the result of this Vuelta. No?
Dog rider, Dimension Dated.
I mean, definitely the first victory of Ben King, which was hard fought and, you know, beautiful victory. If you think that he's never won a race in the World Tour, never won a stage in a Grand Tour, and then, you know, to win one here was, after all the season that we've had and how much hard work we've put into it, was absolutely brilliant. So great for him, and of course great for our team. And then, you know, he backed it up 5 days later or 6 days later with another win, which was, you know, going through the pain barrier like I've never seen any rider do before, and you know, outsmarting some much stronger guys. So yeah, those are massive, massive highlights so far in this race. You know, a cycling team is not made up of, I mean, it's made up of brilliant individuals that come together to, you know, to be a successful unit and a successful outfit in a team event like this. And, you know, the coaches believe in each other again, the directors believe in the strategy again, you know, and the riders believe in themselves again. So a victory, especially one that has taken, you know, a while to get, and our first World Tour victory of the year, you know, that just unites and connects everybody together again. So it's absolutely significant.
Ian Boswell, Team Katusha Alpecin.
To be honest, not much to speak of. I've done a lot of surviving. I guess I've learned a lot by hanging out at the back a lot, but I guess camaraderie within the group, you know. I think when you go through a hard patch, you really see how close you are as a peloton, you know. We're bumping elbows a lot, but when you're struggling, there's a lot of people there to cheer you along.
Ben King, Dimension Data, a double stage winner.
Stage 4 and stage 9 for me, obviously highlights and special for different reasons. I think in 10 years, I'll look back and say stage 9 was more dramatic. I had to fight harder for it. But the first one was the first one, and I'll never forget that.
Antoine Duchesne, Groupama FDJ. I think defending the red jersey was quite amazing. Defending a leader jersey on a Grand Tour like this for 4 days, it was really nice. A little bit unexpected at start. We were aiming for Thibaut and ended up Rudy, so it was nice. A guy like him working for him was really nice.
Alessandro De Marchi, BMC Racing Team. For sure it's the 11th stage, so the third victory for me in a stage of the Vuelta. Yeah, it means a lot because I was waiting 3 years for another victory, and I went through a lot of up and down moments. It's nice to see that here in the world I found again myself and the right feelings.
That brings the curtain down on our daily Grand Tour coverage for the 2018 season, but don't worry, there's still plenty more coming up over the next few weeks. This coming week alone, we've got the audio diary recorded by Conor Dunn and Larry Warbass from their Alpine adventure, which they did when their team Aqua Blue pulled out of the Tour of Britain. We'll also have a diary from riders who were at the Tour of Britain. There'll be a regular episode, of course, plus our final Vuelta press conference. And if you'd like to send in a question for the team, you can do so on WhatsApp by sending a voice message to +44 797 133 8205. That number is also in our Twitter bio, so if you didn't catch it, you can check it there. Richard, Orla and Rose will be back with the cycling podcast Feminin at the end of the week, and we'll have a dispatch from Francois Thomazeau, who was at the recent World Tour races in Canada. After that, Richard and Orla are going to the World Championships in Innsbruck, so we'll have coverage from the men's and women's races there. But that's all from us at the Vuelta a España. A big thank you to our guest host, Fran Reyes, who brought so much Spanish sunshine and flavour to our coverage from Spain. Thank you to RAFA and Science in Sport, our long-term sponsors. It's no exaggeration to say that without their support, we would not be able to cover all three Grand Tours the way we do. The same is true of our friends of the podcast, who support us by paying to listen to our collection of episodes for subscribers. If you're not a friend of the podcast, you can sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com/friends. But thank you to the team behind us who work so hard to help get every episode online. Our producers during the Vuelta were Tom Wally, John Mooney, Adam Bowie, Jonathan Rowe, Will Jones and Paul Scoynes. And they work fast and under pressure each night, so the episodes are online as soon as possible after the stages. Thank you to The Economist for sponsoring Kilometre Zero, and a big thanks to Annette and Jerry Kelly of Grand Tour Art for the illustrations you may have seen on social media that we've used to promote those Kilometre Zero episodes. If any of those works of art take your fancy, you can buy them, or you can buy prints. Go to @GrandTourArt on Twitter, and you can find their website from there. The music you've heard in these episodes and the Kilometre Zero episodes are by Massey Mass and 13 Senses. A big thank you as ever to David Luxton and everyone at David Luxton Associates. And to Alice Glossop and Itziar Gomez for providing the voiceovers for our jingles and introductions. And of course to our Chief Inspector Rob Hatch of the Pronunciation Police for keeping us on our toes. So from Richard, Daniel and me, thank you to all of you for listening, and particularly for the feedback, questions and comments we get on social media and by email. If you want to get in touch with any of us, email contact@thecyclingpodcast.com.
Penn Station is turning up the heat. Introducing the Ghost Pepper Cheese Steak. Grilled fresh with premium steak and fiery ghost pepper cheese. It's craveable, bold, and only here for a limited time. Pair it with Penn Station's famous fresh cut fries and fresh squeezed lemonade for the ultimate flavor hit. Available now through November. Get it before it vanishes. Visit Penn Station today or order on our website or app for delivery. Penn Station, love your sub. You craving what I'm craving?